Before you have a lot of wisdom and experience, sometimes you have to take a job where those three things don't line up, right? But I would make it your career mission to get those three things lined up. And maybe it's gonna take you one job or three jobs or 5 years or 15 years. But when you think about your career, if you ever wanna be just thrilled and passionate about the work you do, that's where you have to get.
That was Dwight Cooper, founder and CEO of Human People Solutions. Dwight is our guest for episode 5 of Innovate Jax, the podcast where we hear the stories of the creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs who will help elevate Jacksonville as a leading southeastern city of innovation. I'm your host, Kate Warnock. Now, on to the interview. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Innovate Jax. This is Kate Warnock, and I am thrilled to have our next guest, Mr. Dwight Cooper. Dwight, welcome.
And I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
We're happy to have you. You are yet another one of our Mary Harvey must-see individuals. So, Mary, again, shout out to you. But, Dwight, researching your background, I am just so thrilled to have your perspective on, you know, something that I think deserves a lot of attention, and that's really talking about staffing and hiring and human resources and culture in the workplace. So you're a master of all.
Great. Some of my favorite topics.
All right. So just for an introduction for our audience, you are the founder and CEO of Human. You're also an employment and culture strategist and a keynote speaker.
That's right.
All right. But in doing research on your background, Dwight, early in your career, I want to start with something that was kind of maybe more formative for all of the above, and that is you were an assistant men's basketball coach at UNF. How did your experience as a coach translate into becoming a recruiter?
Yeah, so in addition to being a basketball coach, my primary role there was to recruit. So it was my first foray into the world of recruitment. But, you know, I think that the whole concept of coaching translates into an awful lot of business disciplines, if you will, right? And when you're coaching and you're recruiting in college, you're trying to build trusting relationships fast, right? And that's the key to being successful at recruiting college athletes or recruiting nurses to hospitals, for example.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. And did you have winning seasons while you were there?
Oh, we were terrible. I'd still be coaching. That's why I'm sitting here talking to you about business now, right?
All right. All right. Well, let's move on then. You founded your first company, PPR Talent Management Group, back in 1996, right here in Jacks Beach. What was the opportunity you saw back then?
Well, it was interesting because I was young. I had no idea how to run or to scale a business. And so, honestly, I thought the opportunity was small. And right when we founded the business, I thought, hey, this is maybe a good way to make a living. Maybe we can have a couple of employees and have a nice lifestyle business. Only because I had self-limitations in the way I thought about what we could be and what we could do. And obviously, as we gained experience and wisdom, we became more confident and were able to take more risks and be more entrepreneurial. And ultimately, we grew a fairly significant business right here in Jacksonville Beach, learning how to do it one day at a time.
You know, you existed through the big recession that hit in 2008. Yes. I was wondering, what lessons did you learn? First of all, how did you survive through that, giving what your business it was, you know, at the time? And, you know, and you were kind of in a niche, weren't you, specific to the healthcare industry. So how did you survive that? And kind of, I also want to hear more about the morale. How did you keep morale up in your company at that time?
Well, let me start by just talking about sort of philosophically where we were going into the recession, because that probably is a largest component of why we were able to survive that and sort of thrive through that. And, you know, we started believing in the early days that the one thing we could be really great at is creating a really great employment circumstance for people. We knew that it was important to, we're all in the people business, we knew that it was important to attract the most talented people to the business, to retain them, to get them working better together as teammates, to have them given discretionary effort. And for that to happen, we have to create an environment where they want to come and do those things every day. And so we put an awful lot of energy for the entire time we owned PPR, and now since we've been here at Human, into creating that environment. And so when you do that, the result is you have an engaged workforce, and your clients and customers and shareholders, that's what they want. They care a little bit less about having a great place to work and a little bit more about a passionately engaged workforce, right?
Right.
And then when we do that, then we can win, right?
Right.
And so that's the environment we set to we set to start the business. And as we moved into the recession, we had a lot of years of just tremendous growth. And as we moved into the recession, we had built a lot of trust. You know, we had really talented people in the organization, passionate people, and we had built a lot of trust. And so when things got tough, and they got tough for us, we lost 50% of our revenue during the year of 2009.
Oh my gosh.
We laid off half of our staff. It was the most gut-wrenching time of my career. At the same time, I was really proud that the half of us that were remaining came here every day and continued to keep that energy and passion. They played for each other, not just for themselves. They cared about each other. We did this with a, we did all those things with a lot of love and a lot of nurturing to those of us who were left behind and really wounded, right?
We
were working together with our backs against the wall. It's one of my favorite things about business. When you face challenging circumstances in business, then you win together with a team. It's one of my favorite feelings. It has a lot of, it's very analogous to coaching a sports team, right? And so that's how we made it through that time. And, you know, we were playing the long game. You know, I think today in business, there are, you know, public companies or private equity owned companies, they're not in a position to play the long game. They're playing the short game. They're like, they're so focused on short-term results, quarterly earnings, you know, selling the business in 3 to 5 years, those kind of windows. And that's a, to me, that's a disadvantage. And so we had the advantage of being a privately held company with the opportunity to play the long game. And that's, and so we were able to continue to commit to people and strategy that was longer term while others weren't able to do that. And I think that helped us win through the recession.
Absolutely. So it sounds like, did you kind of bake that into your strategy then? I imagine that, you were positioned well, even though you lost. I mean, remarkable that you were able to survive losing half of your staff and half of your revenue. But, did it influence how you did business moving forward when you were able to recover from it? And did it kind of change anything in how you approached running
probably,
your business?
It probably changed a lot of things, but it was baked into our strategy, right? And so to create a great place to work and an engaged workforce requires a lot of processes and systems and discipline, right? It's
right.
Not like, hey, we're just going to have a great place to work.
Right.
You know, we have to have processes around communication, top-down communication, bottom-up communication. We have to be mining for information from our employees who are close to the customer. We have to understand how, not only how they're doing from a metrics and KPI perspective, their productivity and performance, but about how they're feeling, right? And how our customers are feeling. And we just kept doing that. We stayed really disciplined of the things that are often not urgent, right? We had, when we were in the middle of the recession, urgent things fly at you a lot, right? And you can get consumed with the urgent at the expense of the important. And so we made sure that was one of our approaches. It is an approach we've always had in our business, but you had to really double down on it during the when times are tough, right? That really exposes, when times are tough, it exposes not only weaknesses in your business, but weaknesses in your team, exposes character flaws and everything else. And so we tried to be true to who we were, continue to execute on all those people processes, because after all, again, we're all in the people business nowadays, right? And we knew that if we could come out on the other side of that recession, keep the team together, keep them working in an engaged, passionate way, that we were going to win. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, the business grew. We had some remarkable growth 3 years leading up to the recession. But really, after the recession, we were a rocket ship. And I give a lot of credit to our ability to kind of keep the team together and rowing in the same direction and playing that long game rather than the short game.
Okay. All right. Well, what a great lead-in. I know that, what was it, around 2016, you decided to take a pivot, and thus became Human.
Yes.
Let's hear a little bit about what made you make that call after being in such a successful realm for so long.
Yeah, we had grown, PPR was the predecessor to Human, and we had grown that business till it was kind of a grown-up, really big business, right? And it had gotten to the point where to scale that business toward to the next level, it was going to be more about transactions and less about executing on an organic strategy, right? It's like, I look at businesses, and I've seen a lot of businesses sort of successfully scale from startup to 100 million in revenue and do that by executing on an organic strategy over a bunch of years, and that's what we had done. But when a business goes from 100 million to 500 million in revenue, that's usually about transactions. It's raising money, buying companies, mergers and acquisitions, right? And so we were sitting there contemplating our future, contemplating our strengths, and we came to the conclusion that it might be the right time to sell that business, right? That maybe that's for someone else to do. Mm. That doesn't really align with what our strengths or our interests are. I wasn't really interested in doing that. So when we took the business to market, it was under the condition that, about 100 of us were gonna leave and move across the street and keep one of the more entrepreneurial, smaller divisions, which ultimately became Human People Solutions, where we're sitting today doing this podcast. And that's exactly what happened. We took it to market under those conditions, not knowing if we could find a buyer under those conditions, where the CEO and half the management team and 80 employees were going to walk out the door. So we were very fortunate to find a good partner who wanted to buy that business. And we felt like it was the right partner for the management team that we were going to leave behind. But we wanted to keep doing entrepreneurial things. And so that's what we did. That's what we're doing. So we have a management team that's been together for really a long time and a lot of employees that have been with us for a long time. But we do have a new brand and new direction with our recruitment process outsourcing business in Human.
All right, so let's hear, before we dive into workplace culture, because you are just the king of all things workplace culture. Tell us a little bit about Human, including that really unusual name.
Yeah, so, when we went through the rebranding process, we really wanted to have a brand that spoke to who we are and how we behave, right? And so we're all about people, right? And so the Human name bubbled up to the surface, but it was spelled uniquely. It's H-U-E-M-A-N. And that U is to represent the many hues of people that we work with and work on behalf of. We hire about 18,000 people a year for 35 partners in about 40 states in the United States. And so we do work with a large, diverse group of people. And so we wanted that to be represented in the name, and thus Human with an E. That was the branding that fell out of our process, and we're really proud of it and excited about it. It is who we are.
Right, right. So tell me, you mentioned that it's more entrepreneurial. In what ways would you define that? What makes you guys more entrepreneurial?
We are still in a very entrepreneurial phase where, relative to the size of PPR, we're a fraction of that size, and we're still making entrepreneurial decisions. We're taking a lot more risks. We're trying new things. We're trying to be innovative. We take chances on new business lines. Things like that we weren't really doing anymore at PPR, because when you have a base of that size and as large as we were, an organic startup means a lot less to the overall business mix, right? When you have a base of the size of the business we're in today, it can be much more impactful. Mm-hmm. So it garners more of our attention and resources. And so we love that part of Human, that we are innovative. We are primarily a recruitment process outsourcing company, but we have five other businesses under the Human umbrella, and we're constantly evaluating and trying new things. And that's part of our culture and our DNA, and our leadership team enjoys working on new things. And that's been a fun part of who we are.
So Dwight, just for the folks who might be wondering, what does recruitment process outsourcing mean?
Yeah, if you really think about the function of talent acquisition within a business, it's usually a subset of HR. You have a leader in HR, but one of the primary areas of HR would be talent acquisition. And so we essentially take that seat. And so we're really more of an in-source solution. So if we have a partner who we're providing RPO services for, we are doing everything that their recruiting department was doing before we were there. And so we're putting in technology and processes and systems around recruiting. We are working under their flag, if you will. We're working in their brand. Candidates would never know that someone is sitting at Human taking a candidate through a hiring process. We look and feel just like we're them. We just drive a lot of technology, processes, systems, wisdom, experience into the recruiting process to make it more efficient.
All right, so the big question is, how is it that you blend so seamlessly into a hiring process that a new hire wouldn't even realize that you're not part of the core team that they're employed by?
It's a collaborative approach. First off, we have to have the right partners that are willing to have us blend seamlessly into their into their process, and right, and our recruiters and our managers of our teams feel like they are part of that team as much as they are our team. They go through new employee orientation at our partners. Their email address has their our partner's name on it.
Mm-hmm.
When we call a candidate, the caller ID has our partner's name in it. Each of these recruiters, we have 120 or so recruiters that work for us. They all sit in a cube with our logo on the cube, but it also has the partner they're working on's logo on the cube. And so we just learned a lot of lessons over the years about how to seamlessly create that integration, a lot of processes and systems to make sure we implement the right way and drive that through our business and our partner's business. And we just get better at it all the time. We're not perfect at it, but we're getting better at it all the time.
Well, Dwight, I think it's a perfect lead into my next question, which really is, you know, again, in exploring your background and preparing for this conversation, the number of awards and accolades that your company has earned really from the start of your career around being a best place to work, having a most engaged workforce, it's almost too numerous to count. So you've cracked the code. And I'm wondering if you can, maybe let's just start at the beginning, you know, what does a successful workplace culture look like?
Well, let me start with why we did it.
Right? Okay.
So one of my mentors said to me one day, you know, if you can really figure out what you can be the best in the world at and do more of that, then you're going to be really successful. Right. And so we do all these transactional things around here that I'm not sure we can be the best in the world at. We can be really good. But we decided in the early phases of our business that we were going to be a values-based, culture-based organization. And that we wanted to create the best workplace in the world, and we just set that as our high bar, right? And then we decide, then we know that what gets measured gets done. So you've seen these accolades because we like to be measured on this, right? And so we typically don't, because our standard is really high, the best place to work, the greatest employment experience in the world is what we're after. And so our standard is super high, our bar is high. We're never going to get there, but we're always striving and reaching towards it. And so what we do is when we ask to be measured, we ask to be measured by national and international organizations, right? So you won't find us in the local newspaper or the trade publication because the bar's too low there for us. We want to be the best in the world. And so you'll find us on the Fortune magazine's Best Place to Work list conducted by the Great Place to Work Institute, which is kind of the preeminent expert on workplace culture. You'll find us on the Gallup's national list for most engaged workforces in the world, because the Gallup organization measures employee engagement like no other. It's sort of a closed loop, right? We measure that, and then we learn what we have to do to be a better workplace, and then we go work on that. We measure what our engagement level is, and then we learn where our shortcomings are, and we go work on that. And it's just a constant process. Whereas some businesses may be more focused on a daily basis on, you know, the financial results of the month. We care about those and pay attention to those. But culture and engagement comes first in our mind. Then we know that if we do that really well, we're in a people business, we're going to attract the right people, they're going to do the right things, and we're going to win on the financial measures as well. Oftentimes, people may view the cultural commitment as being the soft stuff, but the data suggests that organizations who do really well in this area, for example, Fortune magazine's top 100 great places to work that are all public companies, for 15 years have outperformed all other companies, right? And it makes so much sense to us, and that's our approach, and there's different ways to skin this cat when you're trying to grow and execute on a business, but we are just laser focused on that. We start with that, we end with that every week with every strategic planning session, and we've been very fortunate because the results have poured out of it.
All right, you have said so much, and I want to unpack a little bit of it. How about for the folks who are listening today who are really interested in investing more in their workplace culture, where do you begin?
Yeah.
You know, I heard you mention values. You know, I imagine that you probably came up with a mission and a vision statement pretty early on. How did you go about creating something that people could really rally around?
Yeah, great question, and it starts with values, right? It's like before we knew what our values were, there were some of us working here and we were together for a reason. And that reason usually is we have some shared values, right? And so we're not creating values, we're identifying them. Right? Like, what are the values that are core to this group? And then once you do that, and we went through a process to do that. By the way, The one regret I have about that is I wish we'd have gone through a process to really clearly identify our own personal core values and get really clear about them, because I think most people aren't really as clear on the ones that are most core to them. If I ask you what your values were, you may come up with a list of 8 or 10, but there are really 4 or 5 that really drive who you are and how you behave every day, right? And once you identify those and get really clear on them, you start to behave differently. You start to behave more consistent with those values maybe than you did even before, even though they were your values before. And so the same thing applies to our business. We figured out what our values were. We knew they were around teamwork and service and change. And once we identified what those were, then it was a matter of putting processes and systems in place to make sure we hired people that shared those values, right? And once you do that, that gives you the ability to really scale your business, right? Because now all of a sudden, if I've got 150 people who work here today that have shared values, then I can give them a lot of latitude to make decisions in the business. I don't have to stand over them and make those decisions. They don't have to flow. Those decisions don't have to flow through a choke point or somebody looking over that. They can have the freedom to do that. Now, they're going to make mistakes, right? But they're going to be mistakes of the head, not mistakes of the heart, right? Because we have people with shared values, right? And so a lot of process and rigor into making sure we're selecting people with the right values. We have to aggressively fix our mistakes when we mess that up, right? And then reinforce those values on a regular basis and make sure our people understand what our expectations are about how we behave in light of what those values are. And so that's the foundational very first step. And the very first step leads us into the key word, which is building a trusting relationship, right? So if we all have similar values and we have norms and then we have very consistent behavior and processes and systems, that gives us a great environment to build trust. And when you have trust, you can have open dialogues and debates and make better decisions, because you can have open dialogues and debates. And really all those things kind of link together to really enhance the culture, and it becomes a flywheel that you're pushing along slowly at first, but eventually gets momentum and people are attracted to it.
So Dwight, how do you move from identifying those core values and you said processes in place, how do you then know, how do you quantify it so that you know what to measure, so that you can, you know, be evaluated by these remarkable third parties and know that you're doing well? How did you get there?
There's kind of two answers to that, because when you think about values and the intrinsic nature of some of them, the values themselves are hard to evaluate. I'll give you an example. Like, one of our beliefs is the world's changing faster than it ever has. And for us to win, we have to change faster than that, right? So what that requires is for us to create, we have to be change agents. We have to create a lot of change within our business, with our partners and the community and the environment. And so one of our values is about just that. It's about change. And so one of the ways we'll evaluate an interview process, prospective new employees, what we want to glean from that conversation with them is we want to ask them a lot of questions about where they've encountered change in the past, right? We want to see a track record of them encountering change, and then we want to know how they did with that. We want them to tell us, and we don't want to be theoretical about it. We want them to tell us what happened, right? And so if we can do that, if we have somebody, we're in somebody who's had three, interviewing somebody who has had 3 or 4 jobs, maybe we can find a trend that every time they encountered change, that was a negative for them, versus they were change agents making change happen. And so that's has a lot of subjectivity to it, but we are very deliberate in our evaluation process of new employees to see if they are consistent with those values that we have. And that's just an example of the change piece of it, right?
Right.
When it comes to evaluating our success how we're doing from a culture perspective, you know, we've had great partners in the Great Place to Work Institute and Gallup, who really ask the anecdotal questions and get empirical data about how we're doing in these areas, right? What are we doing to engage employees the right way? How do the employees evaluate how we care about them as a person? or how we give them opportunities to learn and grow, or how we give them candid feedback, or how we reward and recognize them, right? And so a lot of the measurement on how we're doing is done by those organizations asking questions about those things.
Right, right. Okay. I have to ask, in your years of experience and working with just such a diverse number of employees, you said you're active in 40 states right now, you have probably encountered a workplace that is looking to turn around a toxic environment.
Right.
How is it that you help that leadership maneuver out of a bad place into a better place?
So fortunately, I've never encountered that in my business because we set it up right from the beginning. However, I have had a number of opportunities to work on this because of our success in this area. I've been invited to participate on some corporate boards. I've specifically been invited to two different corporate boards who had a real issue with this. Mm-hmm. And they asked me to join to try to create some solutions. And really, you know, I'm not a psychologist, and you can often find dysfunction at the management team is the root cause of those issues that you just described. And to me, it's just going back to the coaching thing, right? We're coaching. I get in there and I coach individuals and I coach teams. And really, it's about how do we be more effective communicators? How do we make sure that when we're talking one-on-one to our peers that we're talking about the right things in the right way and we're building trust, right? And so it never happens overnight. It's just a long process of coaching individuals on how to behave in individual settings and in team settings together. So I like to coach individuals, and then I like to coach individuals while they're interacting together.
Right.
Right? And we can talk about the importance of body language and assuming positive intent and those kind of things. And we can get into specific example conversations. I like to solve those problems through trying to solve real business issues and trying to get people behaving in the best possible way to solve those business issues and coaching them on how to do that.
You know, and it makes so much sense, going back to what you said of the ROI behind what people like to consider a soft sort of, you know, the squishy stuff.
Yeah.
Well, that axiom is culture eats strategy for lunch.
Yeah, it does.
And so it can just grind, a great performing business can grind to a halt if you have some players who really need that coaching. So
nothing better than a highly functioning management team. Okay, if you have a highly functioning, when I say highly functioning, talented people, smart, talented people is one thing. When I say smart, the first thing I think of is a really high level of EQ, right? And so people with high EQ understand what's going on around them. They understand what's going on in the business, and they're able to engage in the right conversations to move it forward, right? And so once you have a highly functioning management team that has a high EQ and functions well together, then that's incredibly powerful, right? It's almost like the business they're in doesn't matter, right? If you can get that group of people together, it almost doesn't matter.
So I wonder then if you're a proponent of hiring people who may not have an exact fit for the skill set, but as far as that EQ, the emotional quotient, that they would be a perfect, you know, perfectly aligned with your hiring company's culture. Do you make that recommendation?
Yeah, we really do. And so what we're not looking for are the Stepford Wives, if you will. I don't know if you've seen that movie where all the women of a neighborhood are robots. We're not looking for robots. We want diversity. We want diversity in thought. We want diversity in background. We want diversity in gender. We want diversity in race. We don't want to compromise on the values that are core to us, right? And so I think, you know, when we're in a hiring process, if you say to me, well, I've got this fairly narrow group of candidates I want to choose from because they have certain experiences, it makes it hard to find A, people who fit all those values, but also B, provide the diversity we're looking for in those areas that I mentioned. So we like to open the candidate pool up to a much larger candidate pool and focus a lot on this culture and value match for our organization. And oftentimes, that means we're not hiring people for a certain skill. And it creates a burden on a business like ours because now we have to teach them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll often find, I find that some businesses focus so much on hiring someone with a certain experience or a certain skill set because the teaching part is hard and it takes a while, right? And so we flip that on its head. And in fact, we, you know, like I said earlier, we may have, I don't know, 120 recruiters that work here. I'd say less than 10% of them had any recruiting experience before they walked in the door. That's not what we were looking for. We were looking for the right people first, high EQ people that we could teach how to do this and do it the way we think it should be done as well. And I think that's a little unique compared to some of the competition out there because it's harder.
You know, but also an opportunity that you're teaching people along the method you want them
That's
to
correct.
Follow and not having to untrain
yeah.
behaviors that maybe aren't a great fit for your organization. So I
that's
guess
true.
That's something you probably counsel your clients on, that sometimes, you know, go for that wider population. Let's bring it back down to the individual who's looking to possibly make a pivot in their own career, and they're looking at job opportunities, but they're seeing that their skills don't match 100%. And I know that, you know, research also suggests that women are far more inclined to take themselves out of a candidacy because they feel like they're not 100% of a skill match. And men are more inclined to say, you know what, I'm halfway there or 40% there, I'll give it a try. How is it that you would encourage more people to really consider what their opportunities could be?
Yeah, I think when I coach people as they think about their career paths, always try to ask a couple of questions. One is, what are the things that you're passionate about, right? And let's list those things, right? Not related to a job or business, but what are the things that you're passionate about, right? And then let's make another list and say, where are your talents, right? And so then the third question is the most important one. Where do those two things match up that you create economic value for someone? Right? We're doing something I'm passionate about, actually have some talents that match up with that passion, and I can create economic value in that way, right? And that, you notice I didn't say in what, you know, what job is that or what position that is, but it can give you sort of a directional thought on where you want to go. And I especially talk to a lot of young people about this, and I say, listen, before you have a lot of wisdom and experience, sometimes you have to take a job where those three things don't line up. Right? But I would make it your career mission to get those three things lined up. And maybe it's going to take you one job or three jobs or 5 years or 15 years. But when you think about your career, if you ever want to be just thrilled and passionate about the work you do, that's where you have to get. And that, you know, let's each year, let's try to make more progress towards where those three things line up. So that's my advice to...
Great advice. I love that. And, you know, it makes me think, too, are you seeing the trend of, you know, more people saying, my career is not going to be in a single position?
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, I know of companies where they have these employees that have been there for 30-plus
yeah.
years. Are you seeing that more people in this job market are really looking for more frequent change?
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, I've been at this for a while now, and so I certainly worked and managed in a environment where it wasn't like that, and I'm working and managing this environment today. And I may contradict what most of my peers would say, and I think this is the right way to do it. I think that here at my organization, I want people who are super fired up to be here, and they're passionate and excited about the work they do. And when that passion runs out for this job, they should go somewhere else, right? And so the nice thing about that this change has now been an evolution for a long time is it used to be a scarlet letter that, oh, you've job hopped. And it's not anymore. It's much more accepted within reason, right? And so I'm less concerned about, from a hiring perspective, I'm less concerned about people who've had multiple careers, as long as they have a logical path that they've been on.
Got
right?
It.
A logical path. But honestly, I feel like it's great now that we all get to choose where we work and for how long we work, and we're not held hostage to old norms and traditions.
I love that. All right. If job hopping is kind of becoming more of the trend, we still have these employers who have to invest in retaining
yeah.
that workforce. So what are table stakes these days for a great employer to retain great employees?
Yeah. Well, I'll say one thing that we've evolved to is that, you know, development's a huge part of why we engage people, right? And so we try to meet our people where they are. And I'd say this one shift has made a real difference for us. And the shift is that we are doing the things that we are executing and training and development that will help them be better at their jobs, but we don't stop there. We ask them where they want to be developed. And if they want to learn how to, you know, use an abacus to add and subtract, and it has no relevance to our job, then we're going to look for a way to teach them how to use an abacus to add and subtract. And that builds real loyalty and engagement from our team. And so our motto is that we really want to for people to have individual development plans that matter to them, regardless of whether it matters to the organization.
All right. And if you're coming from a company that doesn't have unlimited resources, and I'm not suggesting that you do, but it's part of your DNA, what about for folks who feel like they just don't have that kind of bandwidth, that kind of budget to cover any kind of training that the individuals is, you know, how do we work there?
Right. No, it's I've been in environments and times and cycles in our business where we've had lots of resources for development training, and I've had been in environments and cycles where we've had very little. I could talk a lot about on a shoestring budget, learn and grow, because that's how I learn how to run this business, right? And so books are inexpensive. They're accessible. I remember when I was trying to learn how to scale a business, I went through about a 2-year period of time where once a month, I just took somebody to lunch, and most of those people I never met before in my life. I reached out to them and said, listen, I know what you're doing over there. I've heard about you. Will you have lunch with me? No one ever said no, like 100% of the time. And sometimes it cost me lunch, right? Other times it cost me coffee. Sometimes I got invited to their office and I just sat across from them and talked for an hour. Then it cost me the gas money it took to drive to their office. And so the resources are there. It takes discipline. It takes a commitment to that person and that individual. And a lot of it's just coaching them, right? Just sitting down and having conversations. And when the conversations you're having don't meet their needs, connecting them with someone else in your network and your organization. So I think the budget for development is often an excuse. There's a lot of hard work that managers and leaders need to engage in and make it a priority with their people to grow them in the ways they need them to grow, in the ways that employee wants to grow. Because if you don't engage them in the way the employee wants to grow, you probably won't keep them.
Right. I love the idea of development being such a critical component of retention. I totally agree with that line of thinking. How is it then that you make leadership truly accountable for culture?
This is really hard.
Yeah, I was going to say, does it belong just to your human resources officer, or does it belong to who?
No, it belongs to everyone. And so this is what takes the most work, right? Because if we just had the same people here all the time running the business, then that would be easy. But we have 150 employees. We have 24 people who manage someone, right? And a lot of those are young up-and-comers. They've just recently been promoted into managerial positions. And so it's a lot easier than folks that have been around for 10 years, but that's not the reality of business. We have to keep paying forward our processes and our systems and our training and our education around creating a great place to work, because there are a lot of really specific disciplines around it. And so we do it in a couple of ways. First off, we try to orient them in the right way, and we spend a lot of time and hours going through orientation for new managers and new leaders in the business. But we all own it. And, I always talk about this. Let's just go back to that development thing, because it's like you said, it is a big part of our culture and retention. And I tell the employees, I'm like, listen, you are 100% responsible for your own development plan. And then I go to the manager and I say, listen, you're 100% responsible for that employee's development plan. And so if we keep that leaning into it in that way, in addition to just the rigor of processes and systems around our culture that've been here forever. For example, we have a 8:31 on every Monday morning. We have a stand-up town hall meeting, right? It's a way to have that's a top-down communication venue, and we're sharing the good, the bad, the ugly that's going on in the business. We talk about the good and bad things that happened last week, some of the systemic things that are going on in the business, and every single week we do that. And we walk into that room, and all of our employees are either on in the room on a call, or it's being taped and they're going to watch it later because they're in two time zones away, right? And so we walk into that room and there is a continuum there. There's one employee down at one end of the spectrum that's listening to every word we're saying. And we rotate this amongst managers, by the way. And so somebody's listening to every word we're saying, and someone's at the other end of the spectrum not listening to a single word we say. And so we tell the leadership, whoever's presenting that day, they're talking to this person who's listening to everything. Come in there, be good, be passionate, talk about the business, and share with them the good, the bad, and the ugly, because that's creating a connection and creating trust, right? I know what's going on in my organization. Now, that's just the top-down version of it. Another thing that I recommend that all leaders do is to be in a weekly, every single week, in at least a 15 to 30-minute one-on-one meeting with every one of their direct reports. If you just create that venue, if it's mandatory that happens in your organization, amazing things happen in that venue. Just create the venue, and then we can work on the agenda and the things that are going to be talked about there. But a big recommendation I have is just that should be that, you know, we should be spending, as leaders and managers, we should be spending more time leading and managing, not having our head down looking at our computer screen.
How do you feel then about, totally understand that, you know, that direct relationship reporting and having that transparency and accessibility? What about folks who are reporting into the managers? How do you feel about them being able to access the top level of leadership, even if it means possibly going around their immediate manager?
Well, you know, it's like we want to, first and foremost, we want to create an environment of open communication. We want to have venues and processes for them to, and create as much trust as we can in the organization where that doesn't happen very often, right? That we want to identify gaps and issues and work on those gaps and issues where we don't have the right trusting environment between whether it's a behavioral issue of the manager or the employee. We're going to be very aggressive about working on those issues to try to allow most of that interaction to happen at that level, right? And so we say to our employees, listen, if you feel like you've done the best you possibly can and had a great results-oriented conversation with your manager and done the best you possibly can and haven't gotten there, then there is someone else to talk to, right? And depending on the circumstances, it's the human resource leader or it's that person's manager, right? And then we ask the managers, we want the managers to allow that to happen. And we're going to say, listen, if that does occur, in the rare case it occurs, there can be no consequences to that employee, right? So that's part of reinforcing the environment. And so are people generally behaving that way? And so and if they don't, then they risk the opportunities for advancement. And in rare occasions, they can't be on the team.
All right, Dwight, I want to take your expertise and pivot externally. You are hiring across many different industries and sectors. Yeah. What's really hot? What's the job that you have the most number of positions that you're trying to fill?
That's a great question. And so we do a lot in healthcare. It's kind of our DNA. And so you know, probably 75% of our hires are in healthcare. You know, the labor markets are sort of the most challenging labor markets of our lifetimes. And what that does is it gives employees the freedom to leave their jobs more frequently. We touched on that earlier. But in some positions, in that hourly wage rate between sort of $10 and $20 an hour, there are a lot of jobs and a lot of opportunities. And there is motivation to leave a job for small compensation differences. What we might perceive as small compensation differences are really important to some of the people in that wage range. And so we've seen a lot of turnover in that area. So the nature of that turnover has made that space really hot. And if you look around at some of our, let's say, hospital clients, where in the old days, we might have been talking about really highly skilled positions, they're still hard to find. But the attention paid to those has been muted a bit by this lower hourly wage group of caregivers and people who are taking care of patients at that lower hourly wage level and causing a real strain on healthcare. And unfortunately, reimbursement for those healthcare organizations dictates certain wage ranges that you can't really do a whole lot about. And so we look at a lot of demand in that sort of $10 to $20 to an hour healthcare positions. We see a lot there. On the other end of the spectrum, data scientists. So that's off the charts. this whole move towards machine learning and artificial intelligence and neural networks and people who have expertise around that, and then married with data scientists who understand big data and know how to manipulate it and read it. You know, that's all stuff that's over my head, but I need that in my organization. And I think there are a lot of organizations like that. And then lastly, this whole, the whole frontier of marketing and how marketing has changed, and experienced digital marketers have a really impact on business development now, more so than they ever have. So those are some of the areas where we're seeing a lot of demand.
Dwight, I wonder if, you know, again, with the emergence of AI and machine learning and you know, how those algorithms are going to kind of maybe take over some of the lower level jobs that we're seeing in the health industry. Are you seeing any of your clients or big employers looking seriously at reskilling their existing workforce so that folks aren't being out of, you know, put out of a job because of a machine coming in, but maybe they're now being able to use that machine to do, you know, kind of the more mundane tasks, and they can focus on a higher level sort of output. Are you seeing more employers, you know,
yet. And I think that's where it has to go. But if, when you think about the labor market today and the urgency around just filling the next position, and the candidates, the prospects or the candidates, they don't need additional training right now. They can get a job, right? And so I think some of the consequences of the machine learning, I think there's a lot of discussion about this topic. There's a lot of fear around it. I think it's augmenting of some of the things we do today. And I think it's certainly gonna advance and mature. And I don't know how to predict what that looks like in the future. But I think 5 or 6 years ago, they would have said by now, this would be a problem, and it's just not. And I don't know how long out into the future that problem gets fixed. But if you look at automation and the automation that's occurred in the last 20, 30 years in our country, for example, I mean, it's remarkable the amount of new automation, but here we are still at almost full employment.
Right.
So we adapt and we change and we do different things. And there are all kinds of short-term pain that's created with that. But as a society, we've been able to digest that change and still thrive and be successful.
All right. You know, I wonder if, do you see those same trends holding true here in Jacksonville? You know, we're Innovate Jacks. We want to know what's happening here on a local level. What are you seeing that way?
Yeah, I think some of the work Innovate Jacks is doing is really important. I think that there are other communities that are ahead of us in incubation and collaboration and being on the cutting edge of technology. But with that said, the advancements that I've seen in the business world in Jacksonville and the types of businesses that have moved into the city and the startups that have occurred, I've seen remarkable progress here in Jacksonville. And really just in the last couple of years, seen the talent improve in this city more. Not only do we have great universities producing great talent here in town, they're actually bringing people to the city that are moving here and staying, which is kind of new, relatively speaking. But people are moving here for other reasons too, which is kind of new as well. And so I don't know what the statistics are, but my guess is that Northeast Florida is growing at a pace that's better and different than other areas. And with that comes all kinds of new talent and opportunities, and I'm excited about it.
You know, as someone who has to recruit people to come and work here in the city of Jacksonville, and these folks may not be familiar with our city, how do you sell us as a location to live, work, and play?
Yeah, I think it's an amazing place. I've lived here for 27 years now, and I've always appreciated the Northeast Florida lifestyle and the access to the water, and we have the professional sports team and all the things that most of the listeners of this podcast will understand. But I think really the key is that it's affordable, right? And so as long as it's all of those things and it's affordable, then our future is really bright, right? I think when you contrast Jacksonville with some of the parts of South Florida where they have all these great things as well, but it's not affordable, that works to our advantage for this period of time that we're in now.
Right. I wonder too, have you found, you know, you being an entrepreneur of so many years, what I've heard people say about Jacksonville is that we're really more willing to collaborate with each other, and there's much less of that cutthroat, competitive sort of nature that you might find in maybe the more mature markets where innovation really is taking place. What's your experience
been
that way?
Just like workplaces, every city has its own culture, right? And I think our city is a very collaborative culture. I do. And it is, I can contrast that with some of the larger markets. You don't see that type of cooperation, especially in large business development markets, New York City's and Chicago's of the world. And so I think it's an opportunity. I think the more collisions we create of smart and talented people, the more ideas are generated, the more businesses are birthed, and the more businesses are able to thrive and grow. So I think that could be another competitive advantage for our city.
And that's exactly why we have Innovate Jax as a podcast, is to really hopefully introduce and feature remarkable people like yourself, so that someone might give you a call and say, I'm totally interested in your realm and want to learn from you. So, well, Dwight Cooper, thank you so much for sharing all of your time and your insights with us today.
Well, good. I've enjoyed our time together and wish you the best, and I'm excited to listen to your series.
All right, great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Innovate Jax. For show notes and a list of all our episodes, go to Furkura.com/InnovateJax. Know a Jacksonville changemaker who'd make a great podcast guest? We want to hear from you. Message us at InnovateJax@Furkura.com. Thanks for listening.